Well, hey everyone, Susan here. I hope you're having an amazing day. I'm so excited for you to hear this interview with this amazing founder. In this show, we are going to talk about what it is like to really take an idea to inception while you're working a full-time job and what it's like to take the risk of saying, hey, you know what? I'm ready to go start my entrepreneurial journey, even though I have a safety net of a job with benefits, and then to go and sell that business and start a new business and to do that where you really see a need and what it's like to then take your wisdom and transition that to being both an entrepreneur and an angel investor. We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to talk about money. We are going to talk about being that person who is willing to look at yourself in the mirror and say, yes, I'm going to give this a try and I'm not afraid to fail. So my guest today is incredible. She is an expert at marketing the invisible. We'll talk about that. She has spent her last 25 years of her career in B2B organizations like Miller Heiman, DLA Piper, HomeFinder.com, and many, many more. She founded Bandwidth Strategy, a fractional CMO and COO consultancy to help growth stage organizations drive the right leads into the funnel that result in closed won business. And, just a little as an aside, she has been acknowledged for her work with Second City. So she has some great analogies, and this is a really fun episode, and you'll hear some humor come through. And the other thing I will say about her is she has been featured in Fast Company, Business Insider, Marketing Drive, and many, many more. And so I'm so excited to bring you Amy Schuster today. And before I do, I just want to say that if you have not followed us on social, on Instagram for Ron Real, on X, LinkedIn, you need to. Make sure you do. Make sure you hit the subscribe button. Apple, God love Apple, made some changes lately. And it's like suddenly we don't have as many listens. And it's not, there's a lot of discussion in the podcast world about why that's happening. But do hit the subscribe button and do please go in and comment. Thousands of you listen to the show every single week. Please go leave a 5-star review and a physical comment. That is going to help the show. So with that, let's get into the show. And I'm excited to bring you this episode with Amy Schuster, founder of Bandwidth. This is Ron Real Entrepreneurship, the show that brings the no-nonsense truth of what is required to start, grow, and scale your business. I am your host, Susan Sly. Well, what is up, Ron Real Entrepreneurs, wherever you are in the world? I hope you are having an incredible day. And when I was giving the introduction for this amazing phenom of a woman, I didn't include the fact that, she is a bona fide soccer mom, like full on out.
No.
Well, give yourself some credit because that is a dance mom like that. I was a dance mom that just doing the hair. It was a thing.
No.
So Amy, I want to jump right in. You know, we're the day we're doing the show, you and I were talking before we started the show, and we were talking about fundraising. We were talking about the environment, especially for women-led startups. We know that less than 2.5% of pitches led by women to VCs actually get funded. There are a lot of us in the space, you and I are both angel investors, that founders, that we want to make a change in this. And so I want to just jump right in. I read a quote by you where you said, you know, so many women, just to paraphrase, are essentially second guessing themselves and not really stepping out and being in their power and starting these companies. And what's your perspective right now on the current landscape in terms of women-led companies? Are you seeing more women actually jumping into the startup game, or are they being cautious? What's your take on it?
Great question, Susan, and thank you for having me. My answer isn't one thing, it's kind of everything, right? We know what a brutal year last year was in terms of fundraising. I think I am personally seeing so much more activity in the space, so many more women in the space, but I also, what's that analogy people say that like once you buy a certain type of car, you tend to see that car over and over again?
Yes.
But I've been angel investing for the last couple of years. I'm now exposed to and seeing it everywhere. And I absolutely love that. As someone who started a business back in 2007, when there was literally no other woman in technology that I knew who was trying to start a business. I knew nothing about fundraising. I knew nothing about incorporation. I didn't have any mentors. I went the whole thing alone for 4 years trying to figure it out. To look at that compared to where people are now, and the clients that I get to support with the, you know, fractional CMO and COO work that I do, I am so pleased to look at that long trajectory and see how much growth there is. Totally agree with you on the statistics in terms of, you know, women-led founders being part of pitches, getting funding. It's got to get better, and we're all working to try to make it better together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you said that, because it, as we dive into your journey, right? There's there was one night I was in LA, and I was getting ready to do a speaking event the next day with, oh my gosh, who was speaking? A bunch of the guys from The Secret. Anyway, this is like years and years ago. And I turn on Biography, and it's Natalie Cole's biography. And she's talking about this quote that you only see the glory, you don't know the story. And you said something so interesting about starting your business 2007 and just sort of going it alone, right? Not having mentors, incubator. Let me ask you this question. Do you think that not just for women, but also for men, that there is the sense that starting a business means you have to go it alone? Do you think that's a perception that people have that holds them back?
I think I guess the answer would be you are the throat to choke, right? You start the business, it's your throat on the line, it's your reputation. But I don't think people go it alone as much as they used to and don't have to. You know, this is a gross overgeneralization, but I don't think many men had to go it alone, just from the point of view of it was just so much easier for them to get capital than it was for someone like me in 2007. I didn't have the relationships. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know how to ask the questions. I didn't know the right contents to put together for a pitch deck. And many guys had to learn that on their own too. And that's certainly not discrediting them. But like all things, I think there aren't enough women doing that. So there weren't enough women doing it. There weren't enough women having success at it that they could create mentorship for the younger generation. There were plenty of guys back in 2007 who were having success and bringing their friends with them. There weren't enough women who had success that could bring their friends with them. There's a great quote by someone I'm really good friends with here in Chicago who says, when you get a seat at the table, bring a chair. Like, we need to bring more chairs for more women to be at those seats, whether it is starting a company, whether it is getting capital for that company, whether it is the mentorship on how to run that company. It's all a place and a time almost 20 years later, that's significantly better than when I started, but we're not there.
No. And I love what you said about that whole piece, Amy, about, you know, bring the chair, because I was in at CES this year, and Shelley Zales, like the female quotient, and we were all getting ready to walk the floor. There was like 500 of us. And there was a woman who said, I'm so tired of everyone saying women need a voice, like women need to be heard. Mm-hmm. And I was like, dang, you know, that it's so true. And we have the listening audience of this show is like 50% guys. Everyone knows, like, I love men. I was raised by an amazing single father. And the thing that men keep telling me, Amy, is like, we had no idea the statistics were what they are. And that's why it's like the being a champion for these women-led startups. And we know women-led startups are actually more profitable in their first 2 years than male-led startups. And so, which is huge. Now, this is very interesting. You know, we're seeing this economy now. And there are a lot of businesses that were started during COVID in 2020, and money was cheap. Money was so cheap and valuations were ridiculously high. Yeah. And then one of the things we know is that from a VC perspective, that a lot of VCs didn't disperse as much because they were supporting the startups that they had already invested in and at these conflated valuations. And so there was less funding happening. We're also seeing this year as being very anemic. A lot of the VC funds, they're like outraising money again internally. So we might not see the disbursements. Now you are part of, I want to dive in, of Josephine and this angel network. And can you talk about that? Like, what is the ethos? What do you focus on? And what do you personally focus on as an investor?
Sure, absolutely. So the Josephine Collective, which is here in Chicago, was started by two amazing women, Desiree Vargas Wrigley and Amy Rosenau. I joined forces with them at the beginning of this year. I was at the time part of another group, and that other group was called Women Angel Chicago. And what our mission was to normalize the idea of angel investing. And we did that through community building, right? It was quarterly events where we sat down and talked about, why is it easier for women to write checks for charity than it is to write a check for investment? Why does that feel more comfortable, but it doesn't feel comfortable to write the check for investment? Why aren't we seeing the deal flow? Where are these deal opportunities? What's the best way to structure this type of deal? So we had a huge outreach towards social and community building to help normalize it. What Josephine had done, which was so interesting, was to actually create a vehicle to do this within an LLC. So when we saw that there was opportunity for both, we joined forces. So now, as a part of Josephine Collective, we have the community building part, which is hugely important. I talk to people all the time. I was talking to a group of women last night. I've never thought about angel investing. How do you angel invest? I don't know if there's dumb questions. I don't want to look stupid. It's a really safe space to come in and ask those types of questions and not feel that you're being judged. And then we actually have, because of Desiree and Amy and their amazing infrastructure, we have all of this deal flow coming in. We have more deals than we can fund. But we ask the collective in each occasion, are you interested in investing? And when we do, we usually write somewhere between $25,000. We've even written up to $100,000 checks. But it's been a really, really exciting part of my evolution, being part of the angel investing community here in Chicago, in just learning the psychology behind all of it. And just props to them for standing this thing up. It's been really cool to be a part of.
I love, like, I'm still floored by that question. Why is it easier for women to write a check for charity than it is to write an angel check, or to write a check investing in another woman-led startup? And it's, Amy, it's so like, it for me, it's just, it's such a visceral piece, because I, as an investor myself, I look for, you've heard it. You invest in the team, right? There are so many great ideas out there, but can the team actually execute? Do they have a path forward? Do they know what their exit strategy is? And all of those pieces. And, you know, as a woman pitching too, it's so interesting. I find sometimes women will ask even tougher questions than men, and they ask different questions than men, which is really interesting. So for you, going back, and here you are, this, you know, going back to, you only see the glory, you don't know the story. Here you are, you're investing, you understand what it's like reverse engineering, but you walked the road of a journey and started a company at the beginning of a recession. So let me ask you about that. Let's go back to 2007. Firstly, where did you get the idea for the company? And what our listeners love to know is, what were those first steps you took? Like, what, you know, because for so many people, there's, you know, if you're starting an LLC or you're starting a C Corp or whatever it is you're starting, or just a home-based business, where'd you get the idea, and what did you do first to get it going?
Yeah, absolutely. I started a business called EcoScene. It was reviews of eco-friendly products and services. For those of us that were around during that time, very similar to Daily Candy or the first iteration of Thrillist, it was that new email marketing, right, that was coming out at the time, where you could gain really big lists of people based on very specific types of needs and interests, sell sponsorships, have subscription models. There was lots of stuff that we were learning and iterating on the go. How I got the idea was, my dog at the time, I'm not sure why, but in 2006, 2007, was this like tidal wave of information about all of these negative products coming out of China for pets. And I wanted to find a dog bed for my dog that wasn't from China, that was recycled, that was eco-friendly. And I got it. It was great. And I was like, well, if I want to know this stuff, other people want to know this stuff too. So started EcoScene, and I bootstrapped for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. I left my job in the spring of 2009, my very stable job at a very large company, gave my parents a heart attack. But my thought process at the time was, I can always go back and do that. There's no question to me that I can go back and do marketing at a big company. I won't always get this shot. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. It was me and my dog. I had to pay my mortgage and make sure the dog had food. And like, these were my big goals at the time. So I did it for another year and a half. I eventually sold it to another company here in Chicago and used that as the springboard for the next iteration of my career, which was starting and scaling, usually post Series A, pre Series B at the time, startups in their marketing efforts, whether they were creating them for the first time or iterating on what they had. But I do want to go back and mention one point, which is, you said people know the glory, not the story. I also don't want to oversell that I am a glorified angel investor, that I know everything that I'm doing, that even as a business owner, like, I'm still learning all the time. So like, while it may seem like the glory, I think this is still the story part. I never want to make it feel, and especially to women that are interested in starting businesses, angel investing, like, even those of us that have done it or done it multiple times, that I got stories to share, but I'm still learning too.
And I love that you said that, Amy. And the reason I say the glory piece is because the number of women who are angel investors, it's so rare that even those of us who are just starting as angel investors, we're already like halfway up the mountain, right? And
crazy.
there's that reference that's like climbing Mount Everest. And I've never, you know, I don't have any experience, but my 90-year-old aunt has been to base camp, the first base camp. But imagine you're at the base of Mount Everest and you can't see the summit, but you can see the clear path to the next base camp. And then you can see the path to the next base camp. And for someone like yourself, you're already past base camp one, base camp two, and the women who are at the bottom still writing the checks to charity, they're looking at you like, she's a badass. She's got this, right? But to get to that point of understanding that need and to be able to be part of what you're doing, you had to walk that journey. And I want to go back, because to leave your job, right? There are a lot of, there is a statistic in the United States that 70% of people want to start a business, less than 7% actually do it. Were you making money in your new venture before you left your job? Or, you know, like, was there some stability in terms of stepping out of the boat and saying, yeah, I can do this, right?
We were making money, not enough to cover my salary for sure. I would say I'd saved a significant amount of money, so I was ready for that. And again, I didn't have a lot of responsibilities at the time, so it was the perfect time in my life. Like, I get why when you're 45 and have three kids, like, that's a really hard thing to do. So, you know, I also have a pretty decent risk tolerance. A lot of folks don't have that. If you do have it and you do have the inclination and you are at a point in your life where it is just you, like, you can always pick yourself back up. You can always go do the thing that you know how to do. Those are the times in your life where it's really cool to just bet on yourself a little bit and try.
Bet on yourself. That's so good. Like, I mean, that, to your point, you had saved money. And the reason I'm hammering this home is that, you know, as we're doing the show, like, I was news scanning, which essentially means I'm on the treadmill in the gym and the news is going. It's like, okay, we're looking at increased mortgage rates. We're looking at, again, money's not as cheap. People are in a lot of debt. One of the things that is raw and real entrepreneurship, I mean, I never want people to think, oh, I'm just going to go like give up my job and start a business and I'm going to build the next unicorn. And there's a period of time, and you said it, where you're not really able to pay yourself, or you're not able to pay yourself market, and that you've got to have the risk tolerance. It is raw and real. Like, even the new startup that I'm doing, I'm not paying myself. So, wow, right? Like, you know, but fortunately I have savings. Fortunately, I built another business that still continues to pay me, but not my market. Like, if I, as a, you know, with a background, like you have such an extensive background and success, you could walk into so many companies and make massive salary plus options plus, 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 right? And the same thing with me. So it does take a lot of guts, a lot of risk. There's no question. So let's talk about bandwidth. So this is a big, and I'm going to lay the table for you to just like rock this, because in the startup world right now, going back to money is not cheap and people starting companies, I wouldn't say it's new, but it's very, very common now to have fractionals. So a fractional CFO, a fractional CTO as you're getting started, and to not, because it allows you off ramps and it de-risks it, as opposed to money's cheap. I can have all this money and I can hire all these people and I'll have everyone and they'll be full-time and I'll pay them all benefits and all of those things. I've done that in my past life, right? So this concept of your fractional C-suite is relatively new, but it also helps to, you know, de-risk it. So how did you decide to start this business, and where did you see that problem that you wanted to solve?
Yes. So I wish I could say that it was a very well-intentioned, laid out plan with a lot of thought behind it. That would be a big fat lie. In the middle of the pandemic, so I'll take you back, December 2019, I was working for an organization. We had a big exit to a large consulting company. And then I took a little bit of time, and then I had a new gig lined up for March 15th, 2020. So that was a massive dumpster fire because the whole world blew up and I was starting at this company. It didn't work. I was there, you know, a couple of months and it wasn't right. And I came out of that and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, the whole world is on fire. It was the summer of, all of this racial unrest, and I just could not get my hands around it. At the end of the year, I got a call from a friend who said, my COO just resigned. I'm in the middle of this massive launch. Can you help? And I was like, yeah, I could help with that. So in the most amazing way, it kicked off what is now my fourth year of being a fractional C-suite for organizations that are B2B. I tell people all the time, I sell the invisible. If you can't buy it at a store and you can't check it out online in a cart, I'm your girl. It's usually long sales cycles. It's sales marketing alignment. It's funnel management. It's all the totally unsexy parts of marketing. It is not the exciting rebrand. It is, and I do some of that, but it is really fundamentals marketing on how you get things stood up. So that's how it started and how it has existed over the last 4 years. What I would say to the answer about de-risking is you're absolutely spot on. It is such a de-risk to be able to bring on a fractional in so many ways. It's just kind of like who you date. Like, who you date at 20 is not likely to be the person. I mean, there are certainly people, my parents are one of them, that have been, you know, together for 50 years. I think the person you are at 20 versus the person you are at 40 are very different. The person that you're going to hire as a CMO when you're a $3 million company is way different than the person that you're going to hire for a CMO at a $15 million company, $20 million company. And you have to figure out how to either bring that person with you or exit that person. And that's usually a super painful process. So the ability to bring someone in who's been to the 15, to the 20, to the $100 million and get them on a halftime basis really allows you to focus on all the other elements of building the business without necessarily having to deal with how am I going to manage this person through the next 18 to 24 to 36 months of that business.
I love that you brought in a dating analogy because you know where my mind went, like, you know, bad dates, like bad dates at 20. Oh, good Lord. Right.
But there were also good dates at 20. And the person that you fell in love with at 20 was an amazing human. And you know, that it's all good. It's goodness. It's just very rarely does that person go all the way through with you. It's hard.
Yeah. Oh no. And because I know that you are a member of Second City, like I just feel like there's this whole dating riff that goes along with startups. I don't know what it is, but I'm just saying like, yeah, I think it could be really good. To your point that this whole concept of talent, and it also is from the pandemic as well, that you know, even my husband, he's a CFO and he, you know, his background first, he was like KPMG, like big accounting. Like if you weren't a $1 billion company, he wasn't working on your account. Then he was working with SNC-Lavalin. Then he was a CFO of a drug company. And, you know, he's the kind of person too, is like, I don't want to be in an office 10 hours a day. I just don't. You know, it's not for me. And there are more and more companies that are like, yes, I want fractionals. And they can even take their fractionals all the way up to the exit because whoever acquires is going to probably put in their own C-suite anyway, right? So I also love what you said about selling the invisible. That's a whole other topic of conversation about marketing, the difference, the nuances, marketing B2B and B2C, right? It is such a different landscape, and you know how you do that. It's incredible. So let me ask you this question from the vantage point of going back to the pandemic. And right now there is this big debate, come back in the office. I don't want to come back in the office. I don't want to work from such and such a place. I want to work from wherever I want to work. What is your vanguard opinion, Amy, on where do you think that debate is going to land? Do you think we're ever going back, or what are your thoughts?
I don't think we're ever going back to 5 days a week for most non service level jobs, right? For those of us that are doing computer work, more what I would probably classify as like white collar. Like, I don't think it's going back to 5 days a week for most organizations. I wrote a piece on this, and I think part of that is a shame. I know that the relationships that I have, the community that I've built, the success that I've had with my business is because of the relationships that I built all along the way working in an office. And I really struggle for the next generation, for my daughter, for all of the women who are not going to have those same relationships and the ability and understanding of how to just stop by and ask someone a quick question without having to make a spot for them on Zoom or in a calendar. The ability for someone to just say, like, we're a bunch of us are going to go to lunch. Like, let's go grab lunch. I think we as women will see our success that we've gained over the last 25, 30, 35, 40 years start to erode because there's not enough of that collegiality and not enough of the mentorship of successful women and successful men who are willing to bring women along with them. So, you know, we're 4 years, it's just the 4 year anniversary, right? Of sort of that first day of lockdown. I think we're still trying to figure it out and figure out what works. And I really do hope for the younger generation. I sound so old when I say that, that there is a somewhat return to work, in a way that supports everyone, because I don't know how you build your skills. And I've gotten a lot of feedback on social from younger folks who, you know, in one way or another said I was out of touch, or, you know, didn't know what I was talking about. I just don't think there's enough perspective there yet. We haven't been doing this long enough to know.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't, to your point, we don't really know what the outcome is going to be. One thing that's really interesting that I've observed is this adaptability. So I did a show with Andrew Bart, who's the CEO of AlgoFace. And so what Andrew did in the whole show is about is bringing people together in a very unique way. So if he, you know, that company, they have their employees, no one works in an office, but what Andrew does is every Wednesday night, there's this wine bar in North Scottsdale, and he buys several bottles of wine and he just invites whoever wants to come. There are like board members, there are, you know, different folks from the company, and people just come and they interact and they connect and they, you know, so it's very interesting. And it's amazing to me, Amy, people want to go to that. Well, just because there's wine, maybe, I don't know, but they want to go to that, but they don't want to go to the office. And I think that when we're seeing some of these big companies saying, yes, you have to come back to the office and this is how it's going to be. The other thing that I really feel is that the pandemic was an opportunity for large companies to get rid of dead wood, to get rid of people in the C-suite who were not innovators, who were doing things in a very old way. I think what we're going to see is, again, going back to this adaptability, we're going to see people in the C-suite, the decision makers, who are saying, okay, if I want to have my best talent, we're going to have to meet halfway. And if that means we meet at a wine bar once a week, or if that means there's like optional office or whatever it is we're going to do, as long as we're productive, it doesn't matter. But people are going to start to demand that. And we're also seeing a talent curve. I want to ask you about that. So the, you know, lots of layoffs. I mean, the layoff meter, I didn't look at it today, but significant, right? And what, because you are such a maven and absolutely not afraid to put your opinion out there, like fearless from, you know, what I've seen, what is your opinion on, given the layoffs, given AI, you know, especially with certain types of marketing, replacing people, what do you think the future is of marketing?
I mean, I'll address it in 2 points. The layoff component of it, I think, I mean, it is directly connected to what we talked about, which is that capital is so expensive right now. And I think capital becomes less expensive, people will hire more. So as the markets go up and down in the way that they are, I don't know that will continue. There will also be new companies, hopefully founded by lots of women, that pick some of that up. AI and marketing, you know, I'm optimistic. I think that it's really an interesting time for all of us who are practitioners. Listen, I have lived through every iteration of SEO is dead, from the first time that it came to be that this is never going to work, to, you know, Google changing algorithms, SEO is going to die this way. And then the, you know, all of the different versions of what that looks like, and it's still not dead and it's still working. Good marketing, good content, good search will always be there. And you need people to help you with that, at least now. It is certainly possible that whatever ChatGPT, AnyWord, any of the other companies that are utilizing this technology will get better. We know that they will. I just don't see how it becomes without human. Will they need as many humans? Maybe not. But there's been lots of industries where they didn't need as many humans, and humans evolve and we figure out the next industry to go to. So I see it as a positive, I'm a first adopter. I like technology. I don't fear technology. So I use it. I like it. But I get where people's fear comes from. I guess if you've watched this world enough, though, you've seen it, the prediction of the end of whatever insert item here, all along, and things come back around.
Yeah. And to your point too, from the marketing standpoint, it's the AI is brilliant at content creation if it has the right prompts, right? Like, I'm very curious about OpenAI with Sora. Like, what I've seen with Sora is mind blowing. When I think about you and I, marketers, you know, from years and years and years, for us to create that kind of video content back in, say, 2005, how much would it have cost and how long would it have taken? Yeah. So when you can type a few lines and the AI is able to interpret intent enough to create the, you know, if for anyone listening, if you haven't, go on YouTube and watch OpenAI's Sora clip of what this new technology is.
Really,
so I'm excited about it just from the speed of deployment. So when I want to get a video out or I want to get some kind of content out to be able to send a message, but as a marketer, I'm very clear on what that message is. But to your point, that human input to really capture intent, AI is not there yet, right? We look at the images created on DALL-E, like, oh my gosh, don't even get me started on that, right?
And it's moving fast. And again, I get why people are fearful. I'll do another analogy, which is more of a coffee analogy, which is you can have Taster's Choice Instacrystals coffee if you want it, right? If you want the lowest level of coffee that's the most homogenized and the most generic you can also go across the street and have a $10 cappuccino that someone has hand-poured flowers into with milk. Like, there's going to be a marketplace for all of it. And I think that, again, the fear I get, let me say this, I get the fear around facial recognition and co-opting of people's personalities and all of that, I think, is legitimate and fearful. As a marketer, I'm not fearful.
Yeah. And I love that. And firstly, you have the best analogies, because I was thinking about the instant coffee aligning with the bad date and the cappuccino with the good date, right? Like, so, you know, I'm just that I'm tracking with you, sister. So I love it.
Thank you.
So my final question for you is that given, if you had to make a prediction, right? So given, again, we've said money's not cheap. You know, there's obviously, you know, AI is a factor. Where would you say, given this current landscape for startups, given the current landscape for the ease of spinning up a company, especially if, you know, they're using fractionals, if you could predict from an optimistic standpoint, the state of entrepreneurship, you know, at this time next year, what would it be? Because I'll say, Amy, just, you know, in front of thousands of people, you know, I've interviewed, I don't know, 400 founders, and I am a founder. And again, going back to, you know, what you in interviews and what you've posted and what you stated, I don't ask, and this is again, like having a conversation with a girlfriend, I don't ask this question. Like, maybe I've asked it twice, but I respect your opinion because I think it's grounded in facts, data, validity, and optimism. And there's enough pessimism in the world. So that's why I'm asking you the question.
Oh my gosh, that's so much pressure.
As much pressure as coaching 6-year-olds playing soccer. I don't know.
The amoeba that runs around the field. What I would say is, again, I go and this is the unfortunate pessimistic part of it, is until the capital markets free up, it's going to be hard. Like, it's just going to be hard. I love that in that barren land, there is this growth of places like Josephine Collective and Oh my God, what was it called? The Fundly that you interviewed. You know, great. Like, let's have more of that stuff coming up and growing so that we have more opportunities for capital. So that to me is the positive side of that. Entrepreneurship, again, cyclical, it's always going to go up and down. And I would say my marketing spin on it is stick to the fundamentals, create good content. Create good content, and you will always be able to use that. If you are trying to skirt the system, if you're trying to play the SEO games, if you're trying to move the algorithms, you will be found out. I listened to the podcast that you did with your daughter, and she had great ideas about how to really utilize one specific platform, being LinkedIn, in a very substantial way. So that I see it as a net positive for other types of capital entering the market, still being hard for entrepreneurs without the big dollars available. But if you want to do well and you want to promote your business in a long, with longevity, focus on creating good content.
I love it. That was like a mic drop, Lady Gaga. So just a,
I get compared to her a lot. I mean, that makes sense.
I 100%. Well, Amy, I cannot thank you enough for being here. And the soccer reference for the, if it's lost on anyone, is before we started the show, we're talking about when little ones are playing soccer, and my son, I didn't tell you, Amy, he's, I speak about him often on the show, and he's neurodivergent. And when he was in soccer at that age, your daughter's age, he would just hug girls. He sat on the field and just hugged girls. And so the kids would be running around like the swarm of bees. And then there would be AJ just like hugging a girl and picking dandelions off the field. So that was his soccer experience. There was not a competitive bone in his body.
God bless him. God bless him. I'm doing cartwheels up until this year. So we finally figured out how to follow the ball, which is a huge positive.
See, and there's a great analogy for exactly what you said with regard to, you know, starting a business and the entrepreneurial landscape is just follow the damn ball. There you go.
Follow the damn ball.
Well, Amy, thanks so much for being on the show. And to all the listeners, Amy and I are bold. We would love a 5-star review. Share the show, tag us. And you know, don't forget to subscribe, because we love to get the entrepreneurial message out to the world. And so with that, God bless, go rock your day, and I will see you in the next episode. All right. Well, I hope you loved the interview with Amy. It was a tremendous, just in terms of her wisdom, her self-actualization, incredible. And I want to give you this week's video diary or audio diary, depending on what you're listening to, what's going on with the pause.ai. So the day I'm doing the show, we are hosting our first Cocktails and Conversations. It's sponsored by Une Femme Wines. And so myself and my co-founder Mia, we have been inviting people like crazy. We have a great group of people coming, the planning's happening. It's going to be great. And it's a really deconstructed event. And I got the vision from Whitney Wolf Hurd, founder of Bumble. So after she left her previous company, she had a vision to go and create something for women in the dating world. And so she started these little meetup groups in different cities all over the US to get feedback from women in terms of what they would want in a dating app. And so from that, she created Bumble, and Bumble went on to make her a multi-billionaire. So why reinvent the wheel? So when I read that, I thought, you know what, let's do the same thing here. So this is our first one. So I will report in on this after it happens. And we have people coming who are physicians, we have founders, we have investors. And it's just really for people to meet, to have conversations about women's health, about technology, and bring a great group of people together. We are in the planning process to do further ones in Atlanta, in Silicon Valley. And Amy and I just talked after the show about doing one in Chicago, where she's from. And the whole focus is to bring investors, bring technologists, bring healthcare practitioners together to talk about this path forward, especially for women's health, because women's health has been under-researched. It has been underserved, and it really is up to women to reclaim their power and be their own advocates. And that's not just women. It's for all sorts of different populations. So I can't solve every problem at once, but I am very focused on menopause and focused on this particular area and how we use artificial intelligence to really help women successfully navigate menopause. So that's what I'm focused on this week. And there's been a lot that has gone on to it. And Chris is moving into our new house. So I've also been a single mom and running, to and from school and track practices and all sorts of other things, in addition to building this company and managing my dad's whole life as his POA. So for those of you with kids at home and aging parents, I love you. God bless you. Please write me, go to studentsly.com, because we're all in it together. It's tough and beautiful and opportunities to learn. There's no questions. So with that, I am so grateful you stayed for this week's diary, and I will be reporting in the next episode.
Hey, this is Susan, and thanks so much for listening to this episode on Raw and Real Entrepreneurship. If this episode or any episode has been helpful to you, you've gotten at least one solid tip from myself or my guests, I would love it if you would leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. After you leave your review, go ahead and email reviews@susansly.com. Let us know where you left the review. And if I read your review on air, you could get a $50 Amazon gift card. And we would so appreciate it, because reviews do help boost the show and get this message all over the world. If you're interested in any of the resources we discussed on the show, go to susansly.com. That's where all the show notes live. And with that, go out there, rock your day, God bless, and I will see you in the next episode.